Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn about a program in a Wisconsin prison that has inmates helping to train service dogs.
First, Governor Walker has called for special elections to be held for two legislative seats that have been open since December. Former Senator Frank Lassay of DePere and former Assembly Representative Keith Rip of Lodi left their offices to join Walker's administration last year.
For months, the governor opted not to hold those elections, arguing that the special elections would cause confusion for voters in the fall when they'd have to vote for those seats again. But a Dane County judge ordered the governor last week to hold elections and gave him a deadline of noon today to schedule them. That judge's decision caused a legal fight and a legislative push to change the law surrounding special elections.
Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Chris.
So it seemed that in recent days, the fight over this issue was going to make its way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We were hearing that maybe the legislature would make some changes. Seems like both efforts kind of fizzled over the last 24 hours or so. What happened over the last couple of days?
It really all led up to today. And the question was, and we kind of knew where the governor was going to be on this, but the question was whether the governor was going to heed that court ordered deadline of noon today. We knew that yesterday when he announced that he was not going to seek an emergency appeal with the state Supreme Court, that it was very likely that he was going to order those elections. He ordered them today in the 1st Senate District and the 42nd Assembly District. And pretty soon after he ordered those elections, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald went on WTMJ radio in Milwaukee and said that he was not going to call a bill for a vote that would have basically erased those elections or change special election laws retroactively so that those elections couldn't happen.
And did Governor Walker explain why he wasn't going to file the appeal to the state's highest courts?
He never did explain that decision there. I mean, we know that he lost three times at the lower court level. The first was last Thursday in Judge Josanne Reynolds' courtroom in Dane County, where she said that the law was clear on this and that the governor had a duty under the law to call these elections. That is when the Republican legislature talked about changing the law potentially. And because those changes were in the works, the Department of Justice, which was representing Walker, went back to Dane County Court and said, would you give us some more time? Could you delay this order? Because the legislature is about to pass these changes. Then you had Judge Richard Neese say, no, I can't rule on a bill that might or might not become law. I have to rule on the law, and the law is clear. You have to hold these elections. The last appeal for Walker was to the state appeals court. He decided to go to an appeals court in southeast Wisconsin, more conservative counties over there versus Dane County, which is obviously a liberal county in Wisconsin. But he got the same result and a pretty stinging rebuke from a judge over in the District 2 Court of Appeals, Judge Riley, who said, quote, representative government and the election of our representatives are never unnecessary, never a waste of taxpayer resources, and the calling of special elections are, as the governor acknowledges, his obligation to follow. So that happened just a few hours after the governor sought that appeal. And so shortly after that, he decided not to pursue this with the state Supreme Court.
And so it sounds like Governor Walker isn't too happy about what went down and some of the parties involved. He was on WTMJ yesterday, and here's what he had to say about some of the parties involved with this special elections case.
It is amazing as to how far out-of-state liberals will go to push a meaningless process that's a waste of the taxpayers' money. But that should be a reminder to everyone who's looking ahead to the ballots this fall, is if you want people who push meaningless things that cost the taxpayers money, go along with Eric Holder and the liberal Democrats who are pushing their agenda in this state. If you want people who are actually going to save your taxpayers money and spend it on things that mean something, then stick with Republicans.
And Governor Walker referring back there to former Obama-era Attorney General Eric Holder, who, as I understand, was sort of behind this lawsuit in the first place, Sean. Is that right?
Yeah. The lawsuit was brought on behalf of Wisconsin plaintiffs who live in these districts. And their argument was pretty simple. We live here. We pay taxes here. Other people have representation. So should we. But Eric Holder definitely brought them the oomph that they needed to pay for the attorneys to bring this in court. And, you know, it's definitely being seen as a victory for Eric Holder's group in this case. They challenged the governor here and they won.
And it seems like Governor Walker, based on what we just heard there, seems like he's taking somewhat of a partisan look maybe on this special elections issue. Is this something that you expect, with the rhetoric that we heard him use there, to be sort of an election issue this coming year?
I don't know if it's a, you know, he might talk about it in terms of Eric Holder trying to force an agenda, because Eric Holder's going to be involved in Wisconsin in other ways too, the same group. It's been involved in the state Supreme Court race. The group that Eric Holder is behind is, it's involved in redistricting challenges. We have a big one that's before the U.S. Supreme Court, so you might hear a lot more from him over time. I don't know if the governor's going to be talking about special elections as an election issue, though. I'm not sure that that's, I'm not sure that it's a winner for him just on those terms alone, because really normally with special elections are just commonplace in Wisconsin. It's not something that we've given a lot of thought to. Governors in the past have called them regularly, including Governor Walker, who, by the way, as a member of the state assembly, was elected in a special election. So they're not usually as unusual as they were this year.
We're talking right now with Sean Johnson, WPR News Capital Bureau Chief. And Sean, I'm wondering, you know, you talked about sort of the precedent in Wisconsin law. From what I can understand, the law says these elections must be called on some kind of prompt basis, but it does leave it a little vague. Do you expect whoever is in power come 2018, whether it be Republicans, Democrats, to take some kind of further legislative action on this issue to kind of clarify what the law says on this?
I'm not sure. I mean, the governor thought it was vague. Enough that because these vacancies occurred in 2017, that he didn't have to hit a deadline for vacancies that occur before the second Tuesday in May in 2018. The circuit court system and the appeals court system did not agree with that. So, and I'm not sure that this would be the kind of thing that a future legislature is going to feel the need to address once we kind of step away from the heat of this moment. There has been some talk, you heard it from Senator Fitzgerald, about how the special elections timelines in Wisconsin could potentially put stress on military or overseas voters. That's something you heard toward the very tail end of the debate on this issue. But if you're talking about changing deadlines for special elections, then you'd also probably need to look at changing deadlines for Wisconsin's February primary and the spring election. Anytime when there's not a lot of time between a primary and a general, it becomes more difficult for people to vote if they're overseas.
And Sean, Democrats in the state house had been pushing Governor Walker to call these special elections. What kind of reaction are we hearing from them today?
Pretty simple. They say it's a win for democracy. I mean, I don't think any way in which you'd look at this and say that they didn't win in this particular fight. There's no guarantee that they're going to win these seats, by the way. I mean, they have said that Governor Walker was not holding these elections because he's afraid that Republicans are going to lose. And that's what happened the last time Wisconsin had a special election in a state Senate district, the 10th Senate district in western Wisconsin. That was a seat that had been Republican for years. Donald Trump carried it by 17 points in the last election, and Democrats came in, Patty Schachner, and won that seat in January. So that you heard talk from Democrats that that's why Republicans aren't calling elections here. But Republicans held these seats before they were vacated. There's a chance they could hold them again after the special elections, or when they're up for election again in November.
So it sounds like both parties are going to have to hit the accelerator here a little bit because we've got this tight deadline for these elections. Do we already have candidates lining up to vie for some of these open legislative seats?
You do. So you've got, at least in the state Senate seat, which is the one that has been getting more attention today, you've got a few candidates who've come out and said they're going to run. Democrat Caleb Frostman announced his candidacy today. And then Republicans Andre Jacques and Alex Renard are also talking about running in that special election. If they want to be senator for the long term, they're basically going to have to run for that special election and then the general election basically at the same time. Not exactly at the same time. There will be some overlap with the campaigns, though.
And so give us, as we wrap up here, just the brief timeline in terms of when we're going to see the primary and then when we're going to see the actual special election.
The actual special election will be on June 12th. The primary, if there is one, it looks like there would be one potentially on the Republican side, would be in May. I don't have the exact date in front of me on that one. But then, you know, the candidates are circulating nominations papers for that race starting right now if they want to. And they have up until early June to do that. And then They have up until mid-April to do that. And then also in mid-April, they can start circulating nomination papers for the November general election and have those wrapped up. And they'll be on the ballot for that in mid-June.
Well, sounds like a lot to cover. Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Chris.
Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He joined us to talk about special elections for two vacant legislative seats and the twists and turns of how we got here.
Inmates at the Jackson County Correctional Institution in Black River Falls happily welcomed a batch of new faces to the facility last week, 11 new puppies.
The puppies arrived for the Can-Do Canine Prison Dog Training Program, where inmates are given the opportunity to train dogs that go on to become service dogs in the community.
Joining us now to tell us more about the program is Diane Larson, Prison Program Instructor for Can-Do Canines. Diane, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Walk us through how this program works. How are the puppies brought to the institution, and who gets to work with them?
Sure. So the organization that I work for has prison programs in five different prisons, two of them in Wisconsin. So the dogs come in when they're about 4 months old, and they stay for about a year. And the guys who are working with them are chosen quite carefully by the staff of the prison to participate in the program. So,
and how are they chosen? What do they look for in those inmates' histories or
yep, they, or so record? They look at the crime that they're in for. They look at their record of how they've done since they've been in prison. They have to get recommendations from some of the staff. It's probably about 50% of the guys who apply for it don't even get interviewed because
it's
so strict.
Popular. And yeah, it's popular too.
It's popular, yep.
And what kind of dogs are these?
The ones that we have currently at Jackson are Black Labs.
I saw a picture, and besides being Black Labs, they are adorable.
All puppies are cute.
All puppies are cute. They were very cute. So this is a second year for the program at Jackson County Correctional Institution. How did the first year go?
The first year went well. You know, the first year of having puppies in a prison is crazy for everyone. It's crazy for the prisons. It's crazy for the inmates. I mean, just all the logistics that they need to go through to have puppies there. It's amazing that we're able to have the puppies in there. So things kind of start to smooth out a little bit, you know, and so the second ones coming in usually tend to be a little bit easier on staff in the institution.
Any changes this time around, learning from the first year's experience?
No, the guys did well, I think. We have a program at Stanley Prison also, that's been there longer, so I have a little more experience in it, so it's not just a blind leading the blind type of situation.
Tell us how the actual training works. What are these dogs learning to do?
So all the ones that are in prison basically could be mobility assist dogs when they come out. They're learning retrieving stuff. They're learning touching stuff. They're learning some stuff of just like letting the inmates know what's going on around them. I come in and I teach a class one time a week, and the guys take what I teach and they go and they have to work on it the rest of the week. Mm-hmm. It's crazy though. In the prison life, I always say to people, it's like a week on the outside, a month on the outside is like a week in prison. Mm. So, you know, you tell these guys to teach their dogs to sit, and you come back the next week and it's like, show me sit. And they're like, okay, you know, so sit. And the dog like does a backflip and goes and vacuums and and does your laundry and come back and sits in front of you.
Well, that was really interesting, Diane, because in reading about this, I hadn't really thought about it, but these inmates, I mean, in some ways, this is all they're doing, is spending time with these dogs and really giving them incredible attention.
They give them incredible attention. They do have 24-hour supervision, but I think one of the misdemeanors that people don't realize on the outside is that most of the inmates have jobs. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these guys work 8 hours, and then they still come back and they train the dogs for a couple hours. Oh.
And they're paired up, so two cellmates mm-hmm. are taking care of one dog,
yep.
right?
Yep, and they live in the cell with the guys.
Wow. Diane Larson, prison program instructor for Can-Do Canines, telling us about a program where inmates are taught how to train puppies who then become service dogs. And you said that you go in and teach a class every week, Diane. How closely are you working with the inmates and helping them develop these skills? Because these are skills they're developing as well.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah, people think it's just about training the dogs, but I tell you, the inmates probably get just as much out of the program as the dogs do. I mean, they're learning patience and responsibility and how to work with other people, and any one of them that's involved with the program, I think, will leave and will not be able to help but be better parents mm-hmm. and better people because of the skills that they're learning in the program.
There's a lot of research about how positive it can be for mental health, physical health, to interact with dogs. I'm guessing for someone who's incarcerated, that connection is really important as well.
Really important. I know a number of the guys that are in the program have said that they've been able to like drop all the meds and stuff that they're on for depression and anxiety and that kind of stuff just from being in the program.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're talking about service dogs that are being trained as puppies by inmates at a Wisconsin prison facility. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a service dog? What kinds of tasks is that dog able to help you with that increases your freedom and your ability to do things for yourself? And maybe you've trained a service dog. We'd love to hear about that as well. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Diane, you said that the dogs are with the inmates in their cells. Is it all week, or are they somewhere else on the weekends?
Well, the dogs go out every other weekend. They get to go home with what we call a foster family. And it's actually a very important part of the program, too. If the dogs had to stay in the prison for the whole year that they were there, they also would become institutionalized. They wouldn't be able to survive in the real world. Mm. The moment they walk out the doors of the prison, it's like they walked into Disneyland.
Wow.
You know. So our fosters who take the dogs on the weekend actually are a very important part of the program. Mm-hmm. We couldn't have the programs in the prisons if it weren't for the fosters who take them out on the weekends.
Well, and that makes sense now that you're saying that, because it seems like the dogs, when they graduate to be service dogs, they're going to be going out
right.
with the people that
Everywhere.
They're helping, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they need to learn all of that. I mean, I've visited a prison a couple of times, but I've not spent time in a prison, but my impression is that it's a pretty loud and overwhelming place. How do the puppies adjust to that?
Yeah, you know, it is. And you would think, like, Jackson has 1,000 inmates, Stanley has 1,500. You would think that the dogs would just get used to chaos, you know, and be okay if when they leave. But it's the same chaos all the time. Mm-hmm. So they get used to the prison life and they kind of tune it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so just like walking out the door of prison, if a leaf goes by, all the dogs are like, oh my God, there goes a leaf. What do I do with that? You know? So it's pretty amazing.
So you said that the dogs or the puppies are 4 months old when they come mm-hmm. into the program.
Yep.
Where are they before that?
Before that, they're actually usually in a Great Start home. And so we have people who volunteer to raise them from 10 weeks until 16 weeks. And before that, they're actually at Duluth Prison in Minnesota.
Hmm.
And those Great Start homes, I usually tell people they do kindergarten with the dogs. They do just like little basic training with them. But yeah. that also is an important role because they get exposed to a lot of stuff before they even come into the prison then.
Mm-hmm. So when the puppies finish their year living with the inmates, are they then ready to transition for the most part to be actual service dogs?
That actually, no. They got the skills, let me tell you. But they do go in for final training when they turn two. So in the prisons, they're kind of doing high school and grade school with the dogs. And then after that, they go to a long-term foster until they turn two. So usually it's about a six-month commitment for those people. And then when they turn two, they go back up to the center and they get to go to college. They get to pick their career.
I actually got really choked up reading about this because there were so many really wonderful aspects of this program. And one was that it's really hard for the inmates to say goodbye to these dogs.
It is hard for the inmates to say goodbye. Yeah, they fall in love with them.
And they spend a lot of time together.
They spend more time with their dogs probably than you spend with yours.
Or my cat.
Right.
I'm a cat. I'll put it out there. I'm a cat person. But
it's okay.
But I also, it seems like this is really geared not just for the dogs or for the people with whom that they're going to work, you know, for the rest of their lives, mm-hmm. but for the inmates too, because you actually provide inmates with videos of the dogs' graduations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's quite... It's, you know, you see a whole room of inmates and they all have tears in their eyes. You know, it's pretty moving. It's pretty satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Do inmates get the chance to participate more than 1 year, or is it so popular mm-hmm. that you have to kind of spread the wealth?
Yeah, no, in our Wisconsin programs, they're able to continue on as long as they want to. It's surprisingly, like, you would think that every inmate in there wants to be in the program, but it's actually, like, we're always looking for more inmates because of the amount of work that it involves, and they have to give up a lot in order to be in the program, a lot of different things that they just took for granted before.
Hmm.
So it actually, it's hard for them. You know, it's a volunteer thing that they do with their free time. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of work. So,
with rewards, but a lot
with rewards. Every one of them will tell you it's worth it. All the work is worth it.
Now, I'm interested. Obviously, the dogs are being trained in how to be service animals, but what kind of training or support does someone who's going to have a service dog for the first time need so that they can kind of get the most out of the experience and the most out of that help?
Yeah, so our organization actually has what we call client service trainers, and they work with the clients who end up getting the dogs, and they have to put in a certain amount of hours, which that isn't my field, but I want to say it's something like 25 hours of training that they have to put in, and then they become certified as a team. Mm-hmm. And so they're not left, I mean, it's not just like, here's your dog. You know, it's quite a process even after the dogs leave us and get paired up with the people.
And one of the things that I did not realize is if you are getting a service dog through other means, it can be very, very expensive. I think I saw a $25,000 price tag.
Yeah, they're now actually saying that they're worth about $30,000.
But through this program, people are able to get them at a much reduced cost.
They get them for free.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's such a benefit to our program, and the reason why the prison systems are such a benefit to us also, because we're able to get a lot of dogs trained at a cost basically of none to us. So, yeah, they pay, I think it's a $50 application fee, and that's the amount that they have to pay to get a dog, which is incredible.
Wow, it sounds like a great program all around and
crazy great.
Really great to learn about. Diane, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Diane Larson, prison program instructor for Can Do Canines. We've been talking about a program where prison inmates are given the opportunity to train dogs that go on to become service dogs.
In the wake of violent events such as the 2015 attack at a Charleston church that left 9 African-American parishioners dead, there are moments of introspection and theories floated about how violence can be prevented. Frequently, the conversations center more on what to do in the moment, such as having more police, more guards, and a show of more force.
But in the wake of recent mass shootings, such as the February 14th shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School or the shooting in Las Vegas that left 59 people dead, many have started to question whether other issues could be at play. Namely, some have wondered if the rigid gender roles boys are expected to live up to could be making these issues worse.
Our next guest is here to talk about the challenges boys have, why they're sometimes angry and isolated, and what parents and society can do to support boys and men to live a more emotionally whole life.
Niobe Way is a professor of developmental psychology at New York University and is the author of Deep Secrets, Boys' Friendships and the Crisis of Connection. Niobe, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a joy to be here.
When we talk about masculinity, what are we talking about exactly?
Yeah, so basically, when I'm referring to masculinity, I'm referring to the element of masculinity that seems to be the most harmful for boys, according to the boys themselves. And that really is the privileging of the sort of self or the individual over relationships and the expectation to be emotionally stoic rather than emotionally vulnerable. And the link, the reason why those two things are particularly detrimental for boys is because, of course, to have quality relationships, you need a certain amount of emotional vulnerability. So if both of them are dismissed and devalued for boys as they grow up, it creates a problem of isolation and loneliness and all sorts of problems. So when I, you know, to clarify to your listeners, this is not an attack on all forms of masculinity. This is really a critique of specific aspects of masculinity that, according to the boys themselves, is most detrimental.
And how early in life are boys being conditioned to be masculine in one way or another?
Right, exactly. So what you find in the research, and some of the research is my own research with teenage boys. I follow the same boys over many, many years. From about 11 to 18. And that was a body of work by Judy Chu from in the early of 4 and 5-year-old boys. And you see basically at both periods, at both developmental periods, I would say middle adolescence in my work, and just as boys enter school, 4 and 5 in Judy's work, which is a real struggle with their coming into, for 4 and 5-year-old boys, they're coming into a context in which for the very first time for some boys who haven't been to daycare, et cetera, they're facing these expectations to not say things, to not reveal that they actually like to play with girls, or that so they create things. In Judy's work, she finds them creating teams like the Mean Team, that doesn't like girls, and even though they privately confess to liking girls and liking to play with girls, but the mean team doesn't allow them to do that. In my work with early adolescents and middle adolescents, you obviously don't have mean teams, but you have a sort of version, a teenage version of that, which is boys at 12, 13, 14 are very explicit about their desire for close friendships with other boys. They say amazingly astute things about the importance of these relationships. If they didn't have them, they would go wacko, quote unquote. And then you hear their language shift about 15, 16, and the language becomes much less soft. It becomes more I don't care or an angry, frustrated expressions. And that's exactly the time, exactly when they start to struggle with finding the close friendships that they want or keeping the ones they have, and they start to sound more angry and frustrated, or the sort of checking out, you know, I don't care voice, is exactly the age that you see the suicide rate in the United States jump up to be five times the rate of girls, and you start to see the boys who are committing these acts of mass violence and just violence in general occurring at very high rates. So most of the boys who are doing the killing and you know, same with sexual assault on campus, of course, college campuses, they're between 16 and 25. And that really is a period of what I'm calling a crisis of connection, where boys have basically been told that to act and to be fully human, meaning to express a desire for friendships and closeness and intimacy and use their natural emotional skills, is girly and gay, and it's discouraged and pathologized, and that boys essentially, as they told me in 13 years old, some boys quote unquote go wacko, which is because they, you know, we know as humans we need these relationships, but yet we live in a culture that doesn't value the very relationships we need.
And Niobe, I was going to ask you about any connection to what's going on physically with boys at that age. And actually, we have a caller who is along those lines. So let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. Marty in Lake Geneva is up. Hi, Marty.
Good afternoon. Maybe an off-the-wall thought, but here it goes. Why not, in these aggressive types, extract X amount of testosterone to get them back down to a less aggressive state?
Interesting question, Marty. So is there a connection? We're talking about an age where young bodies are going through a lot of changes.
Well, this is the interesting thing. So to counter the idea that it's just testosterone, the very age that they're going through puberty and their levels of testosterone are going up, et cetera, is actually the age when they're most expressive and most revealing of this desire for closeness. And then, you know, when they transition is actually when they're starting to look like full-grown men and people are having these expectations that they should now be focusing on the opposite sex rather than having these close friendships. So there's no data that I know of that links this sort of, decline into loneliness and isolation with testosterone. And the anger certainly is, the aggression certainly is, obviously. But the aggression, really, when you listen to boys themselves, and I've been listening to them for almost 30 years, you hear that the aggression comes directly from feelings of exclusion and loneliness. I mean, basically, boys will tell you directly, and they've told me this for almost 30 years, that when they feel lonely, when they feel excluded, when they feel like other people have friends and they don't have friends, and that other people are liked and they're not liked, and nobody's paying attention to them, which is almost true across the board of boys who are violent, they start to feel angry and rageful. And then I do think there's some kind of psychological break that happens, because I don't think people kill other people without having some kind of psychological break. But it's really the sense of isolation provoking that extreme isolation. I mean, we even see it, when we solitary confinement in prisons. You know, men will report to literally, you know, lose their mind in those situations. And essentially, many boys in this culture, unfortunately, feel, you know, in similar circumstances and just radically isolated, and it makes them enraged. And then they have these kind of, for the boys who kill other people or themselves, they have these kind of breaks. So I don't think there's any real evidence to suggest that testosterone's the problem. It's really a culture that's a problem rather than hormones.
We're talking with Niobe Way right now. She's a professor of developmental psychology at New York University, and she's the author of Deep Secrets, Boys, Friendships, and the Crisis of Connection. And Niobe, you say that you've been talking to and listening to boys for many, many years.
Yeah.
Do they share with you whether they wish they could talk to more people, but not knowing how or not knowing who to turn to, that it would be safe to talk about being a boy, being a man?
Right. I mean, it really depends on what age you're talking about. So when you listen, when I work right now with 12-year-old boys in an all-boys school down the street from me in the Lower East Side called the George Jackson Academy, and I work with 12, work means I'm in the classroom with boys trying to work with the English teacher to do an intervention we're doing with boys at the moment. And what you hear from those voices is very clear, you know, a kind of emotional astuteness and open expression that we associate with being a girl, meaning it's incredibly astute, it's watching the human world, they're incredibly good observers of the human world, and then they express the contradictions that they see and all sorts of things, because we create a safe space for boys to talk how they naturally talk, which is like a human being noting these amazing things that humans can do. And then you start to see that boys really go underground. So you start to see the very same boy that said at 13, you know, I love him so much, I can't live without him. You know, it's like you can't explain it. It's just, I know him so well, he knows me so well, I can't live without him. To the boy, the same boy at 15, when asked about his close friends, says immediately, I'm not gay. And, you know, to the very same question. So then you see boys say, the most disturbing quote that I've gotten in some form many, many times is a boy who says at 16, it might be nice to be a girl because then I wouldn't have to be emotionless. Mm. And so, you know, what's amazing to me that I always want to emphasize to your listeners is just the way in which boys tell the story. They directly tell the story. They talk about they reveal their human capacity for deep connection and their amazing ability to read the social and emotional world. And then they tell the story about a culture that tries to stomp that right out of them, that tries to say that if you act like that, you are not a man, you are not a real man. And so we raise boys to go against their nature, our culture does, and then some of them grow up and, you know, and act crazy, meaning, you know, are violent or whatever it is, or commit suicide. So the whole idea is that, you know, if we listen to boys rather than just project our own, you know, stereotypes onto them, you hear a very, very different story. I mean, you hear boys that say, I know exactly what's at the root of the crisis of connection. I know exactly what the solution is. You have to help us nurture these, you know, relational relationships, emotional, social capacities. And allow us to, you know, help us maintain positive relationships. And I would even say, just Judith, something I wanted to add is, it's not simply just having emotional language. It's being able to have close relationships, and you need the emotional language to have those relationships. Because what's really missing is, we sometimes teach boys, or we encourage their empathy or something like that, which is obviously a good step. I'm not criticizing it. But it's not enough. It needs to really be helping boys and girls, obviously, too, but boys have more of the pressure to disconnect, is have them helping healthy friendships, mutually supportive friendships, helping them. You know, you have many boys struggling with trying to actually stay close to their mom or dad, but they don't know how, and they don't want to do it in a way that feels lame, or to be called a mama's boy or whatever it is that we pathologize mm-hmm. boys who are close to their mothers. And anyway, so I just think it really is about not just the emotional part, but the emotional part in the service of fostering social, you know, social skills and social relationships.
We're talking with Niobe Way right now. She's a professor of developmental psychology at New York University, and she's the author of Deep Secrets, Boys, Friendships, and the Crisis of Connection. And she's with us to talk about how raising kind and caring boys can help them in adulthood.
And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. As a parent, have you felt the pressure to have your son act like a man? If you are a man, do the pressure to be tough? Did you feel that pressure? How did it make you feel? What would you like to see change in our society? Give us a call right now at 800-642-1234. Again, that number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Right now, we continue the conversation about how parents and society can support boys so that they can become kind and caring adults. Our guest is Niobe Way. She's a professor of developmental psychology at New York University.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, what questions do you have about raising sweet sons? If you're a man, do you feel as though you were groomed to be angry and distant? What are your thoughts about that? Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Niobe, it's interesting because the feminist movement really allowed girls and women to live their lives on a much bigger scale and in a much larger and more varied landscape. Yep. But some have argued that boys and men were really left behind, and there hasn't been a similar movement to give them that same latitude.
Yeah, well, so it's an interesting phenomenon because it's connected, but not in the way that oftentimes gets presented. So I would argue that the ferocious sort of monitoring of boys not acting like so-called girls or gay kids comes from actually a kind of backlash to a backlash to feminism and the gay rights movement. So the more we sort of have progressed in our allowing women to be, or you know, women in power positions and gay people in power positions, the more ferocious this kind of, you know, to be a man, you have to be not girly and not gay, which is essentially equivalent to, in our culture, relational, emotional, social. Because, you know, it's interesting. I was watching Rebel Without a Cause the other day from 1955, and that is just a much softer version of masculinity in 1955 than we have now. And we don't think it is, but if you rewatch that movie, you will see that James Dean and Natalie Wood, essentially that movie is about teenagers fighting for relationships, fighting for friendships and closeness with their dads. And I just think it's interesting how we think that it's gotten better with norms of masculinity, and I would argue in the past century it's gotten worse, that men are more rigidly monitored to not look like a girl or a gay kid, stereotypically, obviously, because it's that whole thing that kids will even tell me this. You know, my uncle's gay, but don't think I'm gay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that whole sense of I have to distinguish myself and I'm going to do it in the most hyper-masculine, misogynist, you know, homophobic way. You didn't see that in the James Dean character. You know, quite frankly, he's Mr. Softy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the dad is as well, and the other dad of Natalie Wood. I mean, it's just interesting that we think we've progressed, and in some ways we've gone backwards. And I would say it's a backlash. It's a backlash against women and gay people in more positions of power.
Niobe, earlier this week we had a researcher on the show who argued that empathy could be a key to reducing acts of violence. And she pointed to the story of Antoinette Tuff, an elementary school bookkeeper in Georgia who helped prevent a school shooting by talking to the potential shooter. Throughout their conversation, he confided in her that he was suicidal. She managed to get through to him by identifying with him, sharing her own struggles with that, and listening to how he was feeling. If we can replicate that in everyday life, not just in crisis situations, is that a step in the right direction?
In some sense, of course it is. The only thing I worry about is what's happening to the Parkland kids, which is that they're being accused, apparently, of not being empathic enough for the kid who killed all these people. And so I think the problem with the limitation with the empathy when it stops there is then it becomes another way to blame individuals. You weren't empathic enough. And if I want to keep the conversation on a cultural level, we have to take responsibility as a culture that we don't value the very thing we need, the very qualities we have as humans, for boys and men. So we ask boys and men to act like part human or not human at all in terms of not valuing their relationships, not needing their relationships, not, you know, having these emotional and social skills. So it's a cultural problem. It's not an individual problem. And empathy oftentimes, unfortunately, leads to a sort of focus on the individual. We don't value empathy, so that's a cultural problem. So that's why, you know, any intervention that fosters empathy is a great thing. But we have to see it as a cultural problem. And just like we had to bring in gay marriage and change the culture to legalize it, we have to begin to, as a culture, value our close relationships, define maturity about having to, you know, have quality relationships, not just being self-sufficient.
Naomi, I want to get to one of our callers before we run out of time. Yep. Paul in Fort Atkinson is up. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I just had a question or two. I was curious about her experience. I know she probably wrote a book or whatever, but does she have any sons? Does she have any nephews? Has she spent any time as a teacher teaching young boys? Where does all this need for empathy among boys in her mind come from? And then the other part of my question is I think this is part of the problem with what's wrong with America is trying to soften everybody up too much, trying to make playgrounds too safe. Kid falls down and scrapes his knee. You coddle him too much. There's a need for empathy. My son has great empathy for animals. Hmm. He wants to be a zookeeper. He wants to spend his future dealing with stuff like this. And then the other part of it too is this some kind of feminist agenda to demasculate people for some deconstructive purpose?
Okay, Paul, thanks for both of those points. We're running short on time, so Niobe, I want to give you a chance to briefly respond to Paul.
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer to his questions is that everything I say is coming directly from what boys directly tell me. And they've been telling me that over approximately 30 years, and it's thousands of boys by now. So none of this is my construction or my interpretation. This is boys directly saying, I need this, I want this, no one's paying attention, why is nobody paying attention, I want a close friend, I want to be able to do this, and nobody's paying attention. And when I read journals even of kids who have committed suicide, it's the same theme in their journals, that they're starving for connection, deep connection with each other, with their parents, et cetera, and they're being pathologized for that desire. And that is really the root of the problem, and it's not coming from any ideology or agenda. It's coming from the boys themselves.
And briefly, Niobe, we actually did a show yesterday about bringing risk back into playgrounds. And do you see that as being mutually exclusive? Can we develop resilience and grit in kids, but also give them the opportunity to express themselves in these other ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I just think we have to be very careful to not start conflating things that really don't have to do with one another. I mean, helping boys have positive relationships and friendships and have the closeness that they're looking for is very different from the kinds of toys they play out in the playground. And I just think, you know, if we start to conflate it, it becomes sort of silly, because, of course, I think all kids should be able to swing on a tire across the, you know, in a tree, and even though that's lots of risk-filled, they should be able to do it, girls and boys, anybody. And that we do certainly try to protect our children sometimes too much from any kind of risk, which is not helpful for them.
And we'll have to leave it there. Niobe Way, thank you so much for joining us. Niobe Way is a professor of developmental psychology at New York University. She joined us to talk about how we can help boys become kind and caring men. Well, they say that all good things must come to an end. And if you're a fan of campy, made-for-TV movies, well, we have some bittersweet news for you. The website TV Line reported this week that the Sci-Fi Television Network has greenlit a sixth and final Sharknado film, which is set to premiere this summer.
This weird mashup of sharks and tornadoes has been surprisingly popular since the first film launched in 2013. Maybe it's not surprising. I don't know. This time around, though, the main character will apparently be traveling back in time in order to, get this, prevent the events of Sharknado 1 from actually taking place. Oh, and there's also talk of dinosaurs and even taking a ride on Noah's Ark. Sure, why not? Judith, are you going to be watching this film?
Okay, so big confession time. I have not seen any of the Sharknado films. Do you think will I be able to pick up on the plot of Six if I haven't seen 1 through 5?
I think you can probably enjoy it as a standalone title.
As a standalone, I mean, there aren't going to be all kinds of inside jokes.
I don't think plot integrity is sort of a big thing in the series that combines sharks and tornadoes.
Although it seems like they're taking it some pretty interesting places.
They seem like they're taking it in some interesting places. I have an issue with movies that are campy for camp's sake. There's one thing, like when you're watching like an old movie and it's kind of campy, they were just dealing with the hand that they had. Now it's like you're making movies that are just
kind of forcing it.
Forcing the campiness. I'm not on board. Will I watch it? Probably.
Well, maybe we can do a Central Time team retreat and watch Sharknado.
The whole series.
There you go.
That's a great way to kill 20 hours.
Well, coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. This is Central Time.